Ukrainians always have some sort of strategy to get some sort of concession for talks.
Pyongyang might be asking for something as reports say back-channel talks between the U.S. and North Korea are underway. It's Thursday, April 12th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You're part of this program. Please join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, as the United States and China spar over trade, U.S. farmers are very concerned. A renewed battle is shaping up as Asian American students say they're being discriminated against at Harvard. All on today's VOA Asia. There is a report out that the United States and North Korea are holding secret high-level talks ahead of a planned May meeting between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. CNN says the talks are being led by CIA Director Mike Pompeo, who's using intelligence back channels to set up meetings with North Korea in a third country. The CNN report cites sources as saying that Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia has been suggested as a possible neutral location for the meeting, although North Korea has been pushing to hold the talks in their capital of Pyongyang. Media reports indicate North Korea is willing to discuss the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Harry Kazianis, Director of Defense Studies at the Center for the National Interest in Washington, told VOA's Victor Beatty he is skeptical of the North's motives, wondering what the price for such a meeting will be.
Keep in mind, back in 2009, the Kim regime asked for a reported $10 billion just to sit down with South Korea. My question is what are they going to ask from President Donald Trump to sit down and have that summit? They're going to want something, whether it's demand to have the summit in Pyongyang, which would be a huge diplomatic win for Kim Jong-un, or straight-up cash bribe, the ending of the maximum pressure campaign. The North Koreans always have some sort of strategy to get some sort of concession for talks. So they're going to ask for something. Then, just going a little bit further down the field, what would they want for to actually get rid of their nuclear weapons? The demands the North Koreans are going to have are going to be astronomically high. They could ask for things like hundreds of billions of dollars in economic aid. They could ask for, you know, the removal of U.S. troops from the Korean Peninsula. They could even ask for, say, South Korea to get rid of all of its nuclear technology and nuclear reactors. Something we forget is South Korea has over 20-plus nuclear reactors. So when we talk about the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, the North Koreans might have a poison pill there and try to say, well, if we get rid of all of our nuclear technology, Seoul has to do the same. So I think right now we have a lot of unanswered questions. And while I'm hopeful there could be some sort of grand bargain or even a summit, I'm still pretty skeptical.
Some analysts have suggested the president's willingness to meet Kim Jong-un handed North Korea a diplomatic victory, as the U.S. had insisted for years. Any such summit must be preceded by steps toward denuclearization.
If we are going to have some sort of bargain with them, they are going to have to show some sort of willingness to denuclearize. The path, I think, that would be the most logical is some sort of inspections, either UN inspectors or somebody who can vouch for this denuclearization would need to go into North Korea, give a full accounting of all of their nuclear weapons, and then dismantle them, dismantle their reactors, figure out if the North Koreans have transferred any sort of nuclear, you know, information to, say, Iran or somebody else. So these are all the things that would have to happen. And the North Koreans would have to agree to at least some of this before even there could be a summit. Because there's just no way that you could put Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump in a room and just say, okay, guys, you've got to work it out. That doesn't happen in modern international politics anymore. There needs to be deliverables on both sides. That's how summits happen now. So again, we're going to have to see all this shapes out, but I'm not exactly optimistic.
Harry Kazianis said given Mr. Trump's national security team, now headed by former U.N. Ambassador John Bolton, no U.S.-North Korean summit will likely take place unless Pyongyang first lays out a roadmap on what to them denuclearization means. These are among the top Asia stories currently trending on VOAnews.com. The U.S. State Department says there are no restrictions on the travel of Pakistani diplomats in the United States. That after reports in Pakistan and Indian media said their movement would be restricted. Two Reuters journalists accused of violating Myanmar's colonial-era Official Secrets Act will face trial after a court rejected a request to dismiss the case against them. The head of the International Monetary Fund is warning that the global trading system is in danger of being torn apart. Christine Lagarde urging nations to steer clear of protectionism. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. China's President Xi Jinping's promise of economic reforms, including cutting tariffs on car imports, appears to have eased the rising trade frictions with Washington. Xi's speech at the Boao Forum Tuesday comes after days of Beijing and Washington announcing trade tariffs against one another. President Trump praised the speech on Twitter, saying he was very thankful for President Xi of China's kind words on tariffs and automobile barriers. Also, his enlightenment on intellectual property and technology transfers. He said, "We will make great progress together." Now, the increasing trade tensions between the U.S. and China has rattled farmers in the American heartland, the place where many of the products on which China seeks to impose tariffs are produced. As VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports, those farmers once supportive of President Trump are increasingly wary about his stance on global trade and ultimately how it will impact their bottom line.
Most mornings for Illinois farmer Brent Scholl consists of a routine that usually begins in one of several buildings on his farm housing hundreds of pigs.
Every 8 weeks, we get 1,100 pigs get delivered to us,
which Scholl raises for several months before sending them to market.
We sell over 6,000 pigs a year.
It's a costly and labor-intensive, but sometimes profitable process, which Scholl attributes to increased foreign demand for pork.
Every fourth hog of mine goes overseas somewhere. So that's 25 to 28% of what I'm making is coming from foreign dollars.
Foreign dollars at risk if China's proposed 25% tariff on U.S. pork products, a response to U.S. tariffs on Chinese aluminum and steel, is implemented later this year.
So it's a big deal. That fourth of that is all the profit and the last little bit that I can actually pay my expenses. If that's all gone away, we're losing money on this.
I heard one say that the difference between losing money and making money at this moment is exports. And so if he doesn't have as many exports as he did last year, he's going to lose money.
Tamara Nelson is the Senior Director of Commodities for the Illinois Farm Bureau. She says after several years of declining farm income due largely to increased input costs, tariffs will only take away more money from a farmer's dwindling bottom line.
Even though China's tariff might only be 25%, the market might get nervous enough on a given day to have it be a greater discount than that. So it just makes it hard for a farmer to make money.
And not just on pork. Brent Scholl also farms soybeans, and China's threat to impose a tariff on that commodity has already cost Scholl money.
Yesterday, the market went down over 50 cents.
Scholl is concerned China will look elsewhere to obtain cheaper commodities, limiting a key market for U.S. products. He feels there is only one person to blame for his uncertain financial outlook.
Well, right now, I would say our president.
A president Scholl voted for in the 2016 election, despite Trump's tough talk on trade agreements.
If we do a deal with China, if during the course of a negotiation they want to hit the farmers because they think that hits me, I wouldn't say that's nice, but I tell you, our farmers are great patriots. These are great patriots. They understand that they're doing this for the country, and we'll make it up to them. And in the end, they're going to be much stronger than they are right now.
It's a decision Scholl says he is starting to regret.
I thought he was the lesser of two evils. I don't know what I'm thinking right now.
Scholl is holding out hope President Trump's trade tactics will work to protect American jobs and ultimately to negotiate better trade deals. If not, Scholl says it will influence his decision at the ballot box in the next presidential election. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Polo, Illinois.
Happening now in Asia, Sweden is charging a man with spying on Tibetan exiles on behalf of the Chinese security services. A Philippine air and ground assault kills 12 Islamist militants in the south of that country. And Sri Lankan police have arrested two army corporals for their suspected involvement in anti-Muslim riots in that country as well. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. A group representing Asian Americans is claiming that Harvard University's undergraduate admissions practices unlawfully discriminate against Asians. The suit filed in 2014 by an organization named Students for Fair Admissions says that Harvard employs quotas on the number of Asians admitted and holds them to a higher standard than other applicants. That story made news again last week when the U.S. Justice Department in the Trump administration sided with the Asian American group, arguing for Harvard to release more information about its admissions. Edward Bloom is president of Students for Fair Admissions.
We are greatly encouraged that this administration has so far asked the court to make public the information that Harvard has been turned over to us. We would applaud any administration, whether it was the Obama administration when we originally filed this lawsuit or now the Trump administration as this lawsuit is going to trial. We are delighted that an administration is demanding that there be full transparency for the American public.
Not everyone agrees. Kimberly Westfalken is a law professor at the Loyola University Law School in Los Angeles. She has long fought for affirmative action and says the Justice Department has a broader goal than the Harvard lawsuit.
They're only intervening to oppose race-based affirmative action, and they're using this Asian American could be the victims of discrimination as kind of a smokescreen for really just doing what they've long wanted to do. And, you know, and it's been something that's not just this Republican Department of Justice, but many before them, the Reagan administration, Brad Reynolds. It has long been a move of certain justice departments to define the biggest concern about discrimination in America to be discrimination against whites who are rejected, white males who are rejected, quote unquote, reverse discrimination.
And it is on that point that Westfalken agrees with Bloom that Harvard should be more transparent in its admission procedures.
I think Harvard should let us know what its rates of admissions are, and I think there should be a justification of disparities if they're there. And that's separate and distinct, but the disparities I would be looking at would be between Asian Americans and whites, because that's where Asian Americans are going to be penalized.
On that, Edward Bloom agrees.
That is the basis of our lawsuit. Asians are held to a higher standard than whites, African Americans, and Hispanics. And Asian Americans at Harvard, and we believe most of the Ivy League, are purposefully limited in the numbers that they make up at Harvard and other Ivy League schools. So we believe that whites, blacks, and Hispanics are given a boost, while Asians are held back in the admissions process.
Tuesday, a U.S. judge in Boston ruled that both Students for Fair Admissions and Harvard must get together and decide what additional information on the school's admission should be released to the public and how much information should remain secret. Harvard issued a statement to VOA saying Harvard College is responsible for protecting the confidential and highly sensitive personal information that prospective students, none of whom asked to be involved in this dispute, entrust to us every year in their applications. Goes on to say we're committed to safeguarding their privacy while also ensuring that the public has the access that it is entitled to under the law. This is VOA Asia.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
this news alert from VOA Asia. A judge rejects a request for dismissal of a case against two Reuters reporters jailed in Myanmar after being accused of possessing secret government papers. The UN Refugee Agency is set to sign a memorandum of understanding with Bangladesh, laying out a framework for the voluntary repatriation of Rohingya refugees to Myanmar. VOA Asia continues. The science behind the grain that feeds half the world may have taken a big leap forward. Scientists are reporting the biggest improvements in rice productivity in decades. If the results hold up in further tests, it could greatly increase supplies of a critical food staple at a time when the global population is rapidly growing. VOA Steve Barragona has more.
Researchers found a version of a gene that increased the number of branches in the flowering part of the plant. The team used conventional breeding to introduce this gene version into five rice varieties. The new strains produced from 28 to 85% more rice than their parents. That's a huge increase, says University of Arkansas rice breeder Shuyan Shaw.
If we can achieve, say, 6%, we probably can be considered a great achievement.
Shaw was not part of the new study published in the journal Scientific Reports. He cautions that it's a small-scale, controlled experiment, and it's not clear how the results will hold up in farmers' fields. Rice yields have not improved much since the big gains of the so-called Green Revolution of the 1960s, aimed at boosting grain production. Experts say big increases in food production will be necessary to feed the additional 2 billion or so people expected on the planet by 2050. Not all rice varieties tested by the scientists produce the same hefty gains. That's another reason for caution, notes rice geneticist Shannon Pinson with the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
There's something exciting here. I don't think it's as exciting as Green Revolution caliber.
New varieties will be available to farmers in 2 to 4 years. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Indian security forces killed 4 civilians in a village in Kashmir on Wednesday when they opened fire on protesters, pelting them with stones. China said Wednesday that a high-ranking diplomat plans to travel to Pyongyang later this week amid a flurry of diplomacy following North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's surprise visit to Beijing. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Healthcare in the United States doesn't have to take place in a doctor's office or a clinic building. There's some 2,000 mobile health clinics around the country delivering medical, dental, prenatal, and pediatric care, preventative screenings, and more. These vans go where the patients are: libraries, schools, grocery store parking lots, especially in low-income communities. As Faith Lapidus reports, a new program in Houston, Texas, is helping mobile clinic operators find the locations with the greatest need.
Like most pediatricians, Sangamitra Misra will tell you tears are part of the job. These families are lined up to see a doctor in the parking lot of an elementary school near downtown Houston.
The concept of the mobile clinic has really expanded over the last 5 or 10 years. Everyone is thinking of how can we actually get to the families that need help, and it just makes sense.
Many parents are bringing their kids for a regular checkup. For some schools in the district, 30 to 40% of students are behind on their shots.
We have very open arms, and we're ready to really help the families that need our services.
This mobile health clinic is headed out to that particular neighborhood very much by design.
I'm a health economist, so I like to optimize resources.
With support from the National Science Foundation, Rigoberto Delgado wants to help providers like Texas Children's Hospital target their limited resources where they can do the most good.
Dr. Misra is busy concentrating on her patients. She has no time to look at whether she's going to the right places or not. We're trying to complement her services by providing the basis for an objective deployment of our resources.
His team at the University of Texas Health Science Center Houston is doing that by looking at public health data and using geospatial mapping science and predictive analytics to forecast areas of highest risk for disease outbreaks. On this map, the red dots show where the fleet of mobile health clinics routinely visits.
But you can see there's pockets here where it needs to cover more. Not that they're doing a bad job, but they might need more resources or deployed their resources in a different manner.
Okay, come.
Dr. Misra says she welcomes a more numbers-based approach to deciding locations.
Some days we show up, there's 75 children. Some days we show up, there's 5. And so I think this would normalize it a little bit if we knew that there was a certain number of children that really we knew needed our services.
With more demographic data, the Houston team says this approach could be helpful in underserved communities around the world. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Police in Indonesia have announced a crackdown on makers of bootleg liquor as the death toll from consuming the toxic drink reaches 82 people. Police say the liquor consists of methanol and virtually pure alcohol. Police put on display some of the toxic alcohol likely consumed by the victims from Jakarta and neighboring West Java province. Police also said 7 suspects have been detained, and they're seeking 2 others who are on the run. Alcohol-related deaths are reported frequently, but the latest toll is among the highest in recent years. VOA Asia continues. Despite a global abundance of food, a United Nations report says 815 million people, 11% of the world's population, went hungry in 2016. Advances in technology and artificial intelligence can help feed them, but there are challenges that keep first world technologies from reaching the developing world. More from VOA's Elizabeth Lee.
Hunger affects 1 in 9 people globally, and that number is rising. Poverty is not the only reason why.
Increasingly, we're also seeing hunger caused by the displacement related to conflict, natural disaster as well.
Humanitarian organizations are turning to new technologies such as AI or artificial intelligence to fight global food insecurity.
What AI offers us right now is an ability to augment human capacity. So we're not talking about replacing human beings and things, but we're talking about doing things, doing more things and doing them better than we could by just human capacity alone.
Artificial intelligence can analyze large amounts of data to assist farmers in developing countries and locate areas impacted by conflict and natural disasters. The data can then be accessed by farmers from their smartphones.
When you take geospatial data and soil mapping data and use AI to do the analytics, it can send me the information. So in a nutshell, it can help me when to plant, what to plant, how to plant.
When you start combining technologies, AI, robotics, sensors, that's when we see magic start to happen. On farms for production, to increase crop yields.
But the developing world is often the last to get new technologies.
815 million people are hungry, and I can bet you that nearly 814 million out of the 815 million do not have smartphones.
And even when the technology is available, other barriers still exist.
A lot of these people that we talked about that are hungry, they don't speak English. So when we get the insights out of this technology, how are we going to pass it on to them?
While it may take time for new technologies to reach the developing world, many hope such advances will ultimately trickle down to farmers in regions that face food insecurity.
You've invented the technology, the big investment has gone in. Now you're modifying it, which brings the cost down as well. So I think 3 to 4 years maybe, we'll even have some of the things we have here being used there as well.
Those working in humanitarian organizations say entrepreneurs must look outside their own countries to adapt the new technologies to combat global hunger. And farmers will need to be trained so they can harness the power of artificial intelligence to help feed the hungry in the developing world. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes, on SoundCloud as well. Download our podcast, take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com. Also on the radio at DZUP 1602 AM radio at the University of the Philippines, Diliman, Media Biz Radio and Temasek Polytechnic in Singapore. Our thanks to our engineer, Tracy Carter. How about our engineer, Greg Burns, our director, Tracy Carter, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, David Byrd, and Skylar Ogden. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.